In Ukraine today, Russian rockets target civilians in the eastern city of Kharkiv. The curfew is being strictly enforced.
It's been announced that everyone who moves in the city on a vehicle will be, like, shot at because the situation is so bad.
Also today, something that has impressed the globe, Ukrainians resolve to defend their country in the face of overwhelming Russian power.
No fear. Just absolutely no fear.
I'm Marco Werman, and in a major shift, Germany is taking a firm stance against Russia.
Even though Germany is a large weapons producer, it has always insisted not to deliver any weapons to active conflict zones.
But now Germany is arming Ukraine. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being here. For a fifth straight day, fighting rages in Ukraine, even as delegations from Ukraine and Russia held talks in neighboring Belarus. A Russian attack aircraft buzzed over Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, and a brutal assault by Russian military was unleashed. Kharkiv is in eastern Ukraine and is often described as the most Russian-friendly city in the country. But it was hit by a barrage of Russian rockets that fell in residential areas, killing dozens of civilians, including many children. For the more than 1 million people who live in Kharkiv, nightfall brings terror. Kharkiv resident Luda Sviridok is a mother of three. She and her family have moved from their home on the seventh floor of an apartment block into a nearby church office. She says her family is not venturing out of their shelter.
The curfews right now, it has started and we can't move around the city. Like, it's been announced that everyone who moves in the city on a vehicle will be even like shot at because the situation is so bad. Today has been a really tough day. There was shelling all the time, like almost without ceasing. And sometimes it was further, sometimes closer. But yesterday night, the enemy had broken into the city and the army was chasing them and they were shooting right around our building. So we couldn't go anywhere.
You're at the church now, as you said, in a place with no windows, which is good because that means no shattering glass.
Yeah.
It sounds like the shelling on Kharkiv has been indiscriminate, hitting playgrounds and apartment buildings. I mean, as a parent, that's got to be really hard to see.
Yes, it has been hitting the residential districts where there is no army. There are only apartment blocks and schools and nothing else. It was really atrocious that the enemy hit the places where people were staying in the apartments, and one of the schools was burnt.
I know you have a 9-year-old daughter. What has she been telling you through all of this violence?
So when we woke up in the middle of the night to the sound of bombing and shelling, she started trembling and she said, "Mom, if it is the war, I'm not ready because I haven't petted a squirrel yet and it's on my bucket list." She looked really, really scared, and I comforted her and said that everything will be okay. But for her, the first day especially was a real challenge. It was hard. Like, we went down into the subway because it has turned into a shelter, a bomb shelter. And so we had to spend 2 hours in the subway, and we were sitting on the floor. And the people were sitting on the floor with babies. And I have seen people in the basement, like when we were driving around the city, comforting some people from our church. When we heard hard shelling, we took refuge in some of the basements and we saw people living in the basements. It's like a dirty place with a sand on the floor and maybe mice. And people were sharing that at first they were scared of staying there because of the mice and stuff, but the shelling and the bombing was even more terrifying. So they put the blankets and put their kids, little kids, babies on those blankets and they sleep there. So it's a terrible, terrible picture.
What are your concerns for your parents who are remaining in their apartment?
The first day they went with us to the subway as the bomb shelter, but there was no place for them to sit. They had to stand for an hour and they felt terrible, like physically.
Yeah.
And so they told us that they weren't going anywhere from the apartments. There is a basement in the apartment block where they live. They go down this basement in case of a hard shelling.
You also have a teenage son. What is he thinking right now?
Well, he is a little bewildered. Like, he's 19 and he doesn't know what to do in this situation, whether to go and defend his city, or he's scared and at the same time he wants to do something. But I know that a lot of teenagers, they feel panic and they are scared. And a lot of time the bathtub, it's the only safe place in the house. And there is no basement and no cellars. So they sit in the bathtub and sleep in the bathtub. It's a terrible experience.
Luda, from what you're saying, it seems like you have an outlook that feels determined, almost optimistic. It's something the world has seen a lot among Ukrainians in the last few days. Where do you find the strength to cope with your city under relentless attack?
We have been living a peaceful life. Ukrainians are the most peaceful people maybe on the planet Earth, because, as you know, we gave away our nuclear weapons many years ago just because we didn't want to fight with anyone. And the very country who was supposed to guarantee our safety, the very country that was supposed to be our friend, turned against us and is now doing this terrible thing to us. So we are sure that God is going to give us the victory and he's going to put an end to this terrible attempt to control the people's lives on the part of our neighbor.
Your city, Kharkiv, is just 25 miles from Russia. I would guess your family has close ties to Russia?
My mom is Russian. My dad is Ukrainian. But my own brother lives in Russia, but I haven't received a single call from him. I don't know whether he is ashamed or he supports what's going on, but I don't want to be the first to give this call. So I'm waiting for their at least saying I'm sorry for my terrible leader.
Your father's 86 years old and used to be an officer in the Soviet military. How does he feel about Russia now?
Right now, we've had some arguments, and I don't want to continue any discussions right now because I know that it's more important to be together, to be supportive of each other. So maybe after everything finishes, we'll continue our discussions. But right now, I just am trying to be supportive and to be there for them and do what I can do without arguing or fighting.
Right. This weekend, your father, who's in his 80s, he went to the pharmacy. Can you tell us what happened?
My dad went to the pharmacy, and he was standing there for 2 hours when the shelling started. And my mom went down into the basement, and she called me, and she was panicking because she was afraid that my dad was still at the pharmacy, and he didn't want to go down to the basement because he didn't want to lose these 2 hours he had spent standing. So he went inside the building and bought the medicines. And even with the sound of loud shelling, he decided to stay and buy the medicines. And only then he went down into the basement.
Luda, your strength is really impressive, as is that of your family. All the best to you. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Russia is a global energy powerhouse. It supplies about 10% of the world's oil supplies and 40% of Europe's natural gas. The raft of economic sanctions on Russia is rattling energy markets worldwide. Gregory Brew is following all of this. He studies energy policy at Yale University. Gregory, in the short term, how will Russia's war in Ukraine impact worldwide energy markets? What can we say with almost certainty right now?
As I'm sure everybody has been seeing, we've seen a pretty dramatic rise in oil prices over the last several weeks. They're now over $100 a barrel for the first time since 2014. And that's likely to increase as more sanctions are placed on Russia. We haven't seen measures that directly aim at impeding Russian oil and natural gas exports. For the time being, oil and natural gas continue to flow. So in the short term, I think we're certain to see an increase in prices, and that will likely translate into more pain at the pump here in the U.S.
How should we define short term here? I mean, what's going to dictate the time frame?
Well, the war itself will certainly have an impact. We've all been seeing the Ukrainians are putting up a lot more resistance than I think Putin anticipated. If the violence continues, if the war continues for several more weeks, if not months, then prices will likely continue to rise. However, that will give other market actors time to potentially mitigate the rise in prices. OPEC is meeting this week. They may consider an increase in production. The United States continues discussions with Iran in Vienna that may result in a deal over Iran's nuclear program. That may result in increasing Iranian oil production. That will place some downward pressure on prices. So, you know, the short term, next couple of weeks, month or so, we're looking at high oil prices. But as long as prices are high, that may increase interest among U.S. companies to increase investment. So U.S. production may increase. So I would be wary to say that we're looking at long-term high prices. I think prices may change later this year as the supply-demand balance starts to fluctuate.
So that's the petroleum sector. Let's turn specifically to Europe and liquefied natural gas. As I said, 40% of its natural gas comes from Russia. Could Europe cut off imports, or conversely, could Russia cut off supplies?
So this is the big question, I think. It's certainly the big question that Europe is facing right now. Europe has been dependent on Russian natural gas for years, if not decades at this point. So this has really caused a crisis in long-term European energy security. In the short term, inventories in the EU and Europe would probably allow states to last a couple of weeks. But I think this is almost certainly going to set off a long-term shift in Europe as they move away from accepting large amounts of Russian natural gas.
So let's move away from liquefied natural gas and back to oil, because a big headline from the weekend, BP, one of the world's biggest energy companies, announced it would divest its 20% ownership of Russia's state-owned Rosneft oil company. Norway's state oil concern also said it was pulling out of its investments in Russia. What impact would this have on Russia, on global oil markets, and what does that say about where we're headed with this war?
I would put this under the long-term category. Certainly, this has dramatic effects on BP, on BP's bottom line. They're going to have to adjust, shift emphasis towards other assets. In the longer term, I think this will make major companies like BP and others more wary of doing business with Russia. Even if sanctions don't necessarily last, even if Russian oil and natural gas continues to flow in the short term, a crisis like this makes Russia a dangerous partner with which to do business.
Gregory, at the same time, this is 2022. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just issued a dire report today. I mean, we're facing a climate crisis and countries are trying to reach zero emissions while we're in this period of really high energy instability. Is there any silver lining here which would accelerate the push for renewable energies like solar and wind?
I think there absolutely is. You know, speaking as a historian of oil, I like to look at long-term trends. And this crisis has made me think a lot about the crisis of the 1970s, you know, the first oil shock, the Arab oil embargo on the United States in 1973. There was a tremendous interest in the mid-1970s in embracing renewable energy as a way of getting the U.S. off dependence on imported oil. And the major problem they ran into in the 70s was the technology wasn't there, the capital hadn't caught up, we didn't have the capacity to move off oil and gas. I think we have the capacity now. I think this crisis is really going to show the volatility of oil and gas and may, in fact, accelerate an energy transition towards renewable sources.
May accelerate. What do you think might keep that from happening?
Well, I'm always wary of trying to predict the future, particularly when it comes to oil and gas, fossil fuels, and energy in general. And I think there's a lot of talk right now into how renewables offer a less volatile source of energy, both for Europe and for the United States. But the situation could change. Oil and gas and coal remain abundant and may, in fact, become cheap once again. So I would hesitate to call this indicative of an immediate change, but I do think it's signs of a trend.
Gregory Brew studies energy politics at Yale. Thank you very much for your time, Gregory.
Thanks so much.
We'll have more on that latest UN climate report in just a moment. You're listening to The World.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The impacts of climate change have come faster, are more widespread, and worse than expected. And here's the really bad news. Nature in some places is reaching the limits for how much it can adapt. A lack of investment means some communities are running out of time, too. Those are a few of the key findings of a comprehensive new report out today, released by hundreds of scientists working with the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. The world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has more.
For years, the message from scientists about climate change used to be that if we didn't act, it was going to get bad. The message this report is really trying to drive home is that it already is bad. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres today called the assessment an atlas of human suffering.
Nearly half of humanity is living in the danger zone now. Many ecosystems are at the point of no return now. Unchecked carbon pollution is forcing the world's most vulnerable on a frog march to destruction now.
Today's report is one of three released by the IPCC as the latest comprehensive update on climate change since 2014. A major focus of this installment is on adaptation. The assessment found that in some places, ecosystems are no longer able to adapt enough to survive the rapidly changing climate. Ecologist Camille Parmesan is one of the lead authors of the report.
The ones showing the biggest impacts, the ones that are really coming up against their hard limits now, are coastal systems, tropical coral reefs, high mountain systems, Amazon rainforest, long-term studies in intact, old-growth Amazon rainforest is showing that some of those areas have turned from carbon sinks to carbon sources.
In other words, emitting more carbon than they suck up. People who rely on these natural ecosystems are being impacted too, Parmesan says, including indigenous communities in the Arctic, which have seen drastic decreases in some animals they hunt.
Their livelihoods are also tied to those systems, and they're being slammed, to put it unscientifically. These places are really being slammed.
People are more able to adapt to the impacts of climate change than plants and animals. But Adele Thomas, another lead author of the report, says some are already reaching so-called soft limits to adaptation. That's when there's not enough money or proper policy in place to adapt. Small farmers working in hotter, drier conditions and coastal communities are already facing these limits, Thomas said in a virtual press conference.
So what this looks like is that for coastal communities, things like seawalls, putting in sand dunes, or relying on ecosystem-based adaptation, like restoring coral reefs or wetlands, will no longer be financially feasible, or may no longer be technically feasible.
The report finds that a lot more money is needed to help communities adapt. An estimated $127 billion a year by 2030 for developing countries alone. It also found that some death and destruction, called losses and damages in UN jargon, cannot be avoided.
We have clear scientific evidence that losses and damages are being experienced by people and ecosystems around the world now.
More people are dying from heat. Larger areas are being burned by wildfires. Tropical cyclones are more destructive. Water and food system infrastructure is being damaged. This isn't news to Salimiel Haq, a Bangladeshi climate scientist and expert on damages from climate change, who's worked on previous IPCC reports.
Well, the reality of it happening is not news to me at all. I'm sitting here in Bangladesh where it's been happening. I look out my window and I can see it happening. I walk out of my door and I can see it happening.
But so-called losses and damages have become a contentious political issue. So their acknowledgement in a summary document approved word by word by governments is a step forward, Huck says.
For the IPCC to acknowledge it in the summary for policymakers is new because they can't ignore the reality. It's happening.
The report is released as much of the world's attention is focused elsewhere on the war in Ukraine, but its authors urged policymakers to pay attention anyway. The window for action, they say, is closing quickly. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
In Turkey, music fans can't get enough of a new song released by Turkish megastar Tarkan. In a music video that racked up more than 20 million views in just a few days, Tarkan poses as a computer hacker who breaks into Istanbul's cell phones, billboards, and Zoom meetings to bring a message of hope. This will pass. But is he singing about the pandemic or Turkey's increasingly unpopular government? The World's Duri Biskaran reports from Istanbul on what Tarkan's fans have to say.
in Beşiktaş, one of Istanbul's hip waterfront neighborhoods full of students and creatives, it's hard to overstate how big of a deal Tarkan is. We love Tarkan, gush two waiters and a customer named Sevra in a tea house. He's a gentleman, he has a beautiful voice, he's very handsome, Sevra says. Charismatic, a good father. Osman Hakimi, an Afghan immigrant selling sandwiches, is also a fan.
I like the pop music. Tarkan is one of my favorite singers, the young, new generation. I like it.
Tarkan Tevetolu is a German-born Turkish heartthrob with golden pipes. He got big in the 90s and did not stop. And this is his new song, Geçecek, or in Turkish, It Will Pass. He sings, it will pass, it will pass, be hopeful. Those days of flowers are very close, believe me.
Our joy will come back. But then there's little pieces where it's like, oh, is he talking about the pandemic? Is he talking about the president?
Kenan Sharp is a Turkish-American journalist and pop culture writer in Istanbul. He says Tarkan's lyrics can be interpreted in both ways, and that's crucial in Turkey. The ruling AK party here has been in power for almost 20 years. Publicly criticizing them or the Turkish president can lead to lawsuits, harassment, even jail time for artists in Turkey.
So it kind of gives him plausible deniability that it could be all about a lot of different things. But everyone, I think, knows how to read between the lines.
Tarkan has long been outspoken about social justice issues, human rights, and the environment. But his songs usually stay pretty neutral. That's why this one made such a splash.
Ama şöyle bir durum da var.
In this time, when even the opposition cannot raise its voice, Tarkan did it with his song, says İsmail Demir, who runs a bookstore in Istanbul. The video was Tarkan's first solo release in several years. He recently had a kid, and some fans are calling it the new anthem of the opposition.
Sadece Tarkan sanatını icra ediyor yani.
He's just doing his job, but people are finding hope in it, Demir says. At a local pub, Anise Kojabay, a student, says she loves the song, even though Tarkan has been around since before she was born. She says it's still a song that fits his style. I think it's the right thing to do, from an artistic perspective. Her friend, Fatima Nur Tekin, agrees. Someone had to do this, she says. Tarkan recently released a statement saying the song was about a lot of things, including the pandemic and, quote, the course of humanity. For the world, I'm Derya Buzkeran in Istanbul.
And you're listening to The World. Marco here. We were blown away by the support we received during our 2021 fundraiser. Over 775 listeners made donations to support The World. Here are just a few of those supporters. Henning Gatz, Mark E. Ginsburg, Zoya Gleiser, Susan Goodman, Deborah Grant, Dan Hadley, Mark Holly, Simon Holwell, Mary Huth, Louis Jaffe. While I'm not able to individually thank each person who donated, know that here at The World, we are forever grateful for every single person who listens to the show. Half a million people have fled the fighting in Ukraine. Many are arriving in Poland with conflicted feelings.
With all the things that I'm doing, and I still feel pain and guilt and shame for that.
You feel guilty for leaving?
Yes.
The emotional burdens of fleeing war, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has seen some unprecedented reaction from the European Union. In a major foreign policy U-turn, Germany has decided to send weapons to Ukraine. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, a longtime ally of Vladimir Putin, says he will support EU sanctions on Russia. The bloc itself has also agreed to provide some $560 million in military aid to Ukraine. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, is on the line with me now. Let's start with the Germany move, Orla. How big of a change is this for Germany to decide to send military aid to Ukraine?
Yeah, it's pretty seismic. Up until last weekend, even, Germany had been sort of sticking to its long-held post-war peace policy. And it wasn't just that they were refusing to send defensive weaponry to Ukraine. It was also blocking weapons from other countries like Estonia, German-made weapons from countries like Estonia being shipped to Ukraine. So this announcement on Saturday that it was planning to send 1,000 anti-tank weapons and 500 missiles, it really was unprecedented. German political scientists Philip Coker at Leibniz University in Hanover said to me this afternoon, you can't overestimate just how significant this is in terms of German foreign policy.
Probably one of the most significant changes in German foreign policy since World War II. Germany was only involved in the war in Yugoslavia through a NATO mandate. And even though Germany is a large weapons producer, it has always insisted not to deliver any weapons to active conflict zones or to any parties that are part of any major conflict.
And as Coker was saying to me, you know, it's not just that Germany is changing its peace policy, it's also changing its relationship with Russia. You know, Germany had always tried to maintain this smooth economic relationship between the two countries, but this announcement and the halting of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, Olaf Scholz has upended, I guess, that relationship.
It's not just Germany pushing back on Russia. Surprisingly, Hungary as well, also in the EU. But at one point, the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, was saying he was opposed to sanctions on Russia, but not anymore, is he?
Yeah, it's interesting. He did a TV interview last night where he said, look, I don't personally agree with the sanctions, but there is war now, and now is the time to be united. In a way, he's trying to tread a fine line between both the EU and Russia. I mean, only a few weeks ago, he was in Moscow and met Putin, and they had a very amicable meeting. And as you said, he was quite opposed to the sanctions only up until a short time ago. But he has come out now and condemned Russia's actions in Ukraine. And one other key thing to remember, of course, with Orban is that he has an election in about 5 weeks' time. So he needs to make sure that whatever he says now over the next few weeks keeps his voters and his supporters on board.
Now, for the EU committing $560 million in military aid to Ukraine, that is also significant. Has the European Union done this at this scale before?
No, they haven't. The EU's own treaties actually barred the bloc from using its budget, its sort of normal budget, to fund military operations. So they had to tap into a completely different budget even to do this. I mean, Ursula von der Leyen herself, the EU Commission President, yesterday called it a watershed moment for the European Union. The thing about the EU, of course, is that the EU doesn't have its own army and it doesn't have its own defence forces. So it would never be sending troops in. But for the EU to offer military aid, even like this, is unprecedented.
The other notable change, Orla, from the EU is that it's opening its borders to Ukrainians fleeing the fighting. What has the EU done as far as changing the asylum process?
Yeah, so what they've said essentially is that now Ukrainians will be able to cross over into the EU without having to apply for asylum, and that will remain in place for the next 3 years. It's a very different response, Marco, as you can remember and imagine, from what we saw only, you know, 6 or 7 years ago in 2015 during the migrant crisis.
Right.
Yeah, you know, we had Poland's interior minister saying a couple of days ago, anyone fleeing from bombs, from Russian rifles, you can count on the support of the Polish state. You know, we saw Poland over a few months ago effectively starving people on no man's land coming in from Belarus who were fleeing from Syria and Afghanistan and building barbed wire along its borders to prevent migrants coming into the country. So this really is a turnabout by some countries. But there is a lot of comment over the last few days that there is a hint of xenophobia in the reaction from some EU states to all of this, because the refugees are Europeans and not from the Middle East and not from Africa, and they're being treated differently by some countries. You know, certainly Hungary and Poland are two countries that are behaving very differently towards people coming in from Ukraine than what they did to people coming in from Syria and Afghanistan.
Yeah. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
500,000 people have fled the fighting in Ukraine in the past few days. That's according to the United Nations Refugee Agency. Most of them are heading for Poland, which is already home to a large Ukrainian population. The newest arrivals have been coming into the Polish border town of Smeszler on jam-packed trains, trying to reunite with their families or seeking shelter. Andrew Connolly has been speaking with some of them as they arrive at the station.
Days before the Russian invasion, Anna Friedrichsen left her home in Kyiv for a trip in the western city of Lviv.
Yeah, I was thinking that I'm going for a vacation. I took some skirts, pink skirts and like dresses, and now I have only one pair of shoes.
Anna ran an advertising agency back in Kyiv, and life was good.
Beautiful city, and city was lots of cultural events, and it was a rave capital for the last few years.
Draped in a long pink jacket, Anna's eagerly waiting for her best friend to disembark one of the trains. In the meantime, she calls her parents, who insisted on staying put in Kyiv.
But I want to go home. I just want to hug my parents.
That's it. And I think they are also relieved that you're here and
yes,
you're safe.
Yes, they are, but I still, with all the things that I'm doing, and I still feel pain and guilt and shame for that.
You feel guilty for leaving?
Yes.
The next morning at breakfast at my hotel, I meet Ryan Weaver from Belfast, Maine, who until last year had a very different life.
I was a direct salesman in America, where I bring something to you and...
Traveling salesman?
Yes, sometimes door-to-door. And
selling what?
Air purification, water purification, and Electrolux vacuums, actually. Yeah, the vacuum guy that knocks on your door. But...
Until he moved to Ukraine to work as a teacher, and then fell in love.
I'm definitely going back one way or another. I don't know when or how, what that looks like. But
so she's still there?
Shvika is. She's from Lugansk, so it's just like she's really desensitized to war in some ways.
Vika stayed. Ryan fled, taking trains and walking nearly 20 miles to the border of Poland. Endless groups of the newly displaced weave through Przemyśl's 19th-century Baroque station hall, met by crowds of Polish volunteers offering free rides to cities across the country. But not everyone knows where to go. Outside the station, Polina, a 23-year-old professional interpreter, has just arrived. She preferred not to give her last name.
Actually, I don't have any plans. I don't know what's going on and what should I do here. So it's all a nightmare. What's going on in my country? It's all a country. It's very hard being a refugee and now seek refuge here in an unknown country. And I've arrived here myself. Nobody else. And my family has... I've left my family in Ukraine. My family has stayed in Ukraine.
Where are you from in Ukraine?
I'm from Donetsk region. Well, originally, the war happened originally. I'm from Kramatorsk.
In 2014, Russian-backed militants seized control of territory in Ukraine's east.
Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 23.
You're 23 and you're from eastern Ukraine, so this is the second war that you're facing in your life.
Yes, yes.
On the other side of the train station, Oleksiy Bondarenko, who lives in London, is waiting for his aunt and grandmother to be allowed to disembark the train. Like many, they didn't leave immediately when war started.
Kyiv was kind of considered to be safe. And then, you know, a missile struck a flat like 100 meters away from where my grandma and my aunt were living. So then we decided to move on and to kind of...
Oleksiy's grandmother is 83 and has seen a lot of upheaval in Ukraine in her time. But still, he's concerned.
The reality is that she's probably now experiencing, you know, the worst part of period of her life.
First, Oleksiy will take them to stay with family in Italy before returning to his day job as a university teacher.
What do you teach?
Russian politics. Yeah, it seems crazy, but it's true.
And now that Russian politics has upended the life of Oleksiy, everyone here at the train station, and the millions that could soon follow them. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly in Przemyśle, Poland.
The position of Turkey regarding this war is interesting. A little geography is in order. Turkey separates the Mediterranean from the Black Sea, just to the south of Ukraine. By virtue of that geographic position, Turkey controls the Bosphorus and Dardanelles Straits, the way into the Mediterranean from the Black Sea. Yesterday, Turkey's foreign minister said the situation in Ukraine has become a war. That distinction gives Turkey the right, during wartime, to potentially ban Russian warships from passing through its strategic choke points. It's a tricky dance, though, for the Turkish government in Ankara. It's a member of NATO, but also has close ties with Moscow.
This will be taken in the West as a clear stance of Ankara to side with Ukraine.
Sinan Ulgen is a former Turkish diplomat and director of the Istanbul-based think tank İDAM.
However, in order to prevent any strong reaction, Ankara would portray this not so much as a political decision, but as a treaty obligation.
That treaty is the 1936 Montreux Convention, which gives Turkey the right to block warships from accessing the Black Sea. But Sinan Ulgen says the treaty also has limitations.
So despite the official decision to close the straits to the passage of Russian warships, Turkey nonetheless has also the obligation to allow the transit of warships that are going back to the Black Sea to their original port.
Russia has already built up a significant force in the Black Sea in recent months. Ships and a submarine that pass from the Mediterranean through the Turkish Straits. Turkey does not have the authority to now force those ships to leave. It's rare for scholars to actually fight in conflicts they study, but that's exactly the position Oleksiy Nozdrachov finds himself in right now. Over the past few days, he's gone from writing academic papers on defense and security to fighting to defend his city of Kyiv. Nozdrachov is with the Central Military Science and Research Institute. Oleksiy, it's approaching evening again in Kyiv right now. Can you describe what last night was like and what you're seeing and expecting tonight?
Frankly speaking, the last night in Kyiv was a little bit quiet in comparison with two nights before. We started last night with promises of Belarus authority to launch a negotiation, and the president of Ukraine decided to let Belarus not be fully involved in Russian invasion in Ukraine, giving a chance to be the neighbor, good neighbor in the future for Ukraine.
Right. So Belarus is just to the north of Ukraine, and it's a straight shot to Kyiv. It's very close to the border. Let's just get clear on that, because we know that Belarus and its president Lukashenko are allied with Putin. But so far, have you seen any signs of the Belarusian army near or attacking Kyiv?
No. There was a couple of pictures with the logistic units, with the parts of Belarus uniforms in there. But we do not see the special force or airborne forces or air force of Belarus being directly involved in invasion approaching to Kyiv.
During these negotiations, has the Russian military been attacking Kyiv throughout?
Sure. During this negotiation, the first time for all 5 days of the war, Russians launched massive artillery and missile strike against civilians. We do understand that this is red line which Putin just crossed, starting direct pre-planned annihilation of civilians.
There are videos circulating of Russian tanks getting blown up by Ukrainian soldiers shooting what looked to be shoulder-mounted Javelin missiles. Is this sort of David versus Goliath scrappy fighting typical of what stopped the Russian forces so far?
Absolutely. And we see that the all Russian strategy with massive armor and tank troops now facing the 21st century technology of mobile weaponry, which is extremely effective. Every small unit, every civilians could be trained to use this weapon just using mobile tactics, strike and run, killing the Russian forces.
So what capabilities does the Ukrainian military have that you think is an advantage?
We have absolutely huge support from our people. The second strong part is the 8 years of experience fighting against Russian on the east.
Oleksiy, as I said, you hit pause on your academic work to fight in Kyiv. What have you been doing in the effort to defend the city?
So we, as military scientists and academics, we are first of all officers and military personnel with experience fighting the war on the east.
So you were in Donbass and fighting there for some time.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And I was fighting since 2014 until 2019. And in 2017, I was deputy anti-terrorist operation commander. Unfortunately, I'm not on the front line right now helping our young, brave soldiers to hunt Russian forces. But the soldier, captain and colonels in trained army must be on their places.
So what has it been like for you as a colonel returning from academia to the battlefield?
I would say I could do more. And as I see situation, I will do more. But right now, to be a mature colonel, I will keep my emotion and do my job.
Alexei, what has surprised you so far about the Ukrainian defenses against the Russian military invasion?
No fear. Just no, absolutely no fear.
Did you think that there might be some fear?
Well, we are humans, and yeah, this is our weakest part, right? So we still have blood, we have children, we have wives, and we think every second about their security in democratic, European, independent Ukraine.
Oleksiy Nozrachov is an academic at the Central Military Science and Research Institute of the Ukrainian Armed Forces. He's in Kyiv. He's also been fighting to defend his city. Oleksiy, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The war in Ukraine has us riveted. We do want to highlight a few other stories right now, stories that would be making headlines in less fraught times. Australia has declared an unprecedented weather emergency. Intense rain and floods have hit the eastern part of Australia, killing at least 8 people. Videos show people in rowboats making their way through streets. In the city of Lismore in New South Wales, waters have risen up to the second stories of homes.
I've never seen it like this ever. Like, it's in our second story, and it's never done that.
That woman speaking with the BBC. In London, news from archaeologists that they've uncovered a once-in-a-lifetime find, a beautiful, colorful Roman mosaic floor, nearly 10 feet across and believed to be 1,800 years old. It was discovered during an excavation to build a multi-use development. And in Saudi Arabia, a true Cinderella story.
We're set.
Ready, riders, come on.
And away they go. Jumping away, Emlyn Road was the one who was slowest away. And
the Saudi Cup is the world's richest horse race. The Saudi-trained horse Emlyn Road had an 80-to-1 shot to win. And through much of the race, the horse performed to expectations, but then somehow found the gas and kept creeping up from 7th place down the stretch. Wow, 80-to-1 to win. You do the math. Returning now to Ukraine. In 2022, war is not limited to the battlefield. Russia and Ukraine are also fighting an information war right now. Russian state media continue to spread propaganda and false narratives. Kyiv is trying to counter that and rally Ukrainians to defend their country. There's also the threat of a cyber war. Cybersecurity expert Dmitry Alperovich heads up the Silverado Policy Accelerator think tank based in Washington and has been across the cyber threat.
Cyber has actually not been used a whole lot in Ukraine. There have been some destructive attacks early on in the lead up to the war, but they've been relatively minor compared to the past activities we've seen from Russia. And I think it's an indication that Russians believe that they can win this conflict without resorting to cyber. And in fact, they didn't even try to take down the internet infrastructure in Ukraine, which was certainly a big mistake for them because now the whole world is seeing these horrible images come out of Ukraine of dead women and children and the destruction of cities that the Russians are causing. So they've completely lost the information battle here because of their inability to suppress the internet in the country.
So are you concerned that the Kremlin will now increase cyber attacks, and what could that look like?
I don't think they will increase it in Ukraine. I think they're mobilizing forces for a kinetic attack that is much greater than what we've seen up till now, with significant use of artillery and tactical aviation to bomb Kyiv and other parts of Ukraine. On the cyber front, however, I do worry a lot about the use of cyber attacks against the West. Now that these very severe sanctions have gone into effect against Russia, they're choking the Russian economy. And I do believe that in retaliation for it, we may very well experience cyber attacks directed against our financial sector and potentially our energy sector as well.
Why has the Kremlin not cut out internet and communications? How do you explain that?
You know, that's been the most puzzling element of all of this. And the reality is that they're probably much more reliant on it than we realize. There's reporting now coming out of Ukraine that Russian soldiers, instead of using their military communication devices, are using cell phones, are using consumer radios. So that may be one of the reasons why they have not tried to shut down the internet, because they themselves are so relying on it.
So there is cyber war, which we've been discussing, and so far it seems that hasn't really been activated by Russia, as you said. Then there are the mis- and disinformation campaigns, a propaganda war, which frankly is metastasized beyond government campaigns. Citizens, as we know, also act as delivery systems for this. When we see videos uploaded online, short clips from the battlefield, do these posts put people in danger?
They certainly can. And, you know, one of the things you have to give the Ukrainians credit for is that their information campaign has been absolutely spectacular. And the Russians, you know, we'll see what happens with the actual war on the ground, but they've already lost the information war here. The Ukrainians have been much more aggressive at promoting their successes, their military successes on the ground, the losses that the Russians are experiencing. Not all of them are verified even, and it's not clear if they're all accurate, but nevertheless, they've taken the bull by the horns and ran with it and have portrayed to the whole world what aggressors the Russians are. And they've been able to show the Russians how to really do information operations effectively.
And what about the information war when it comes to the military realm? Are the Russian and Ukrainian militaries both using geolocations and other methods to track the enemy troops? And what are the risks of that?
They are. And, you know, Google just shut down traffic indicators on their Google Maps in Ukraine because there was concern that the Russians were using it to look at traffic jams, which could be indication of Ukrainian troop movements. So everyone is looking at open source information. They're looking at images and videos that are coming out to determine where the troop positions are.
Well, I don't need to tell you, Dmitry, about all the information and disinformation flooding social media. I mean, this is a war that's being tracked online as it unfolds. The fire hose of information, some accurate, some false, how does it impact the overall understanding of events on the ground? And in return, can it actually impact the course of the war?
I think it can. And this is, again, where the Ukrainians have done a tremendous job putting out a narrative that may not always be correct, but they've pushed it out very aggressively that they're able to stand up to the mighty Russian army and defeat it on a number of occasions. There's been these mythical stories that have come out about the valiant defense on Snake Island of the 13 troops that decided not to surrender to the Russians and died a heroic death. Information about whether that actually happened or not. But regardless of whether it's true, it's part of the mythology of the war now. And the Ukrainians have gotten so many people around the world to join their side, which in return has gotten the politicians to put very aggressive sanctions on Russia. And Europe is united as it's ever been and has taken more aggressive actions than anyone ever expected of them.
Dmitry, what are your own contacts in Russia or Ukraine right now? And how has that taken your understanding of this war from analyst to a more personal level?
Yeah, I'm in constant touch with people on the ground in Ukraine. They're telling me what's happening in terms of the attacks that they're experiencing. The images that are coming out are just so gut-wrenching. The death, the destruction in Ukraine, and it's all for naught. It's all because of one man's ego, Vladimir Putin's, that decided to not allow Ukraine to turn to the West and decided to bring it in to Russia's sphere of influence through use of force. And I think it will backfire badly for him.
Dmitry Alperovich is a cybersecurity expert and head of the Silverado Policy Accelerator think tank, speaking with us about how cyber operations have been deployed since Russian forces invaded Ukraine. Dmitry, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That is where we wrap today. Tomorrow, we'll be back with more on the latest in Ukraine and, of course, other news from across the globe. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. Thank you for listening.